Hi, good afternoon. This is John Campbell calling. I'm actually situated in southern England at the moment, and my show here is called Miracle Hour. And what I'll be doing over the next weeks on a Tuesday at between 12 to 1 Pacific Standard Time is to explore miracles in people's lives and miracle things that I've experienced since I kind of woke up, which is about 10 years ago. I was living a very unconscious life. And I'm going to have some interesting guests on, and I've got a great guest for you today. And anybody who wants to call in and speak to my guest or myself, please invite you to do that. And we're going to have some fun. And, you know, I think what I've found over the last 10 years is the journey that I've been on is it's kind of been meandering in my case. You know, I was pretty unconscious 10 years ago, and I'd gotten really came to my knees. I was living a very unconscious life in the corporate world, and a lot of corruptness and stuff like that, riddled with a lot of guilt. And in the end, my drinking had taken a turn for the worse, and I started to get to a stage where I was spilling more than I drank. So I figured that was the time to change. And when I did that, it was a miracle that happened there. Somebody came back into my life who I hadn't seen for 15 years, completely out of the blue, and as what I find seems to happen, and started to tell me his story, and somehow that must have resonated with me, and I went into a treatment center, and I had a very, very big spiritual awakening, and when I came out, I got out of that business. And I started this fantastic journey of exploration, and it's taken me down all sorts of roads, and you know, up here, down here, and been and met some fantastic people, interesting people, and I feel really now that I'm really grateful for being alive in these times, because I think there's a massive awakening going on all across the world. You know, everywhere I turn, I hear stories about people, you know, awakening in their own way. And I was reading a quote the other day from a great Sufi poet called Hafiz, and I loved it. He said something to the effect, he said, at the end of the day, we only have two choices. We either come to God dressed for dancing, or we get wheeled into God's ward on a stretcher. And I really like that, because I think that's what happens. And in my case, you know, I was wheeled in on a stretcher, but it wasn't too bad. But what we're going to do over the next few weeks, as I said, is explore different areas where people are experiencing miracles, and they come in very different forms. And I did a lot of healing work. You know, I had to realize that underneath my use of alcohol and also work as well and all this stuff, there was a lot of resentment, a lot of grievances being held, and I did a lot of healing of that, and eventually I came across this amazing, what I think is a spiritual masterpiece, you know, called A Course in Miracles, and like so often happens, I was given the book very early on. I was doing a course at college, and one of my college friends said, oh, this is this great book. And, of course, I was attracted by the name. I thought, oh, you know, miracles, that sounds pretty good, you know, do some miracles. And I got it, and, of course, it looked like the Bible, and it was very biblical in its language. And so I got a copy, and I put it on the shelf, and I didn't really look at it. Two or three times I may have pulled it down, but the language was so heavy and stuff like that. And I didn't. But the interesting thing was, in the move that I made, you know, I got rid of so many books and you know, traded books in and gave them away. But I never got rid of that book. I always, for some reason, I held on to it. And then what led me to really start studying the course, and I want to really emphasize here, that's what I consider I am. I'm a student of the course, and I'll be a perennial student. But what happened was I came across this book, The Disappearance of the Universe by Gary Renard, and that title jumped out at me, and I didn't know what it was about. till I opened it and found out it was a kind of explanation of A Course in Miracles in everyday language, but in a very unique manner. And that book really inspired me to start studying the Course and the Course principles, and it just made perfect sense to me. Everything about the book made perfect sense. And I think one of the things that I enjoyed was the fact that there was no guru required. There was no institution or organization that anybody had to adhere to. It is a self-study course. And of course, there's a lot of support from, you know, people, other people and students. And I found the whole story about how it came about fascinating. So I started to study it and started to do the lessons. And I started to see changes happening in my life, pretty profound changes. So for me, I feel that I found a real path for me. And, you know, that there are many, many pathways there. I love that concept that, you know, that's one destination, many pathways, and the course is not for everybody. And it may not be for you listening here today, and it may be. And the one thing I would always encourage everybody is to go with that inner teacher. And the fact that the end result is the same. But I think what the course kind of gives out is that it is, if you're looking for a way to get home quickly, it offers that, I think, you know. One of the things that I love was just the introduction itself to the course, you know, and I'd just like to read that because it is very, very powerful. And it says, this is A Course in Miracles. It is a required course, only the time you take it is voluntary. Free will does not mean that you can establish the curriculum. It means only that you can elect what you want to take at a given time. The course does not aim at teaching the meaning of love, for that is beyond what can be taught. It does aim, however, at removing the blocks to the awareness of love's presence, which is your natural inheritance. The opposite of love is fear, but what is all-encompassing can have no opposite. This course can therefore be summed up very simply in this way. Nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God. And when I read that introduction, you know, it made perfect sense to me. And it started to get me to reevaluate. Of course, the thing that the course does, and I'll put a warning out to you right now, is it is a course which will challenge everything you may have learned in your life, and it certainly has done for me. But it's something I love, I'm passionate about, and for anybody who's interested, you know, I love to share what has helped me. And I'm going to speak with people who were also, you know, students of the course, and today Patrick Hauser, who's going to come on very shortly. I met Patrick probably about 6 years ago, and I went and joined a breathwork course, which he and his wife Binny Dansby ran, and it was a life changing experience for me. And as Binny taught the course really from the heart, it was a wonderful experience. So we're going to go through and go through different life processes. You know, we're going to talk over the weeks about birth, and Patrick's going to talk to you today about his organization, Fathers to Be, which is an amazing venture that he started, and honoring the miracle of fathers, you know, and their involvement in the birth process. But he'll tell you about that. And then we're going to, you know, explore relationships, which, you know, I'm sure that nobody has any problem out there with relationships that are listening to this radio station. So, you know, we'll go through that and what the purpose of they are. And then also talk about education, which is the passion of my wife and I. We both passionately believe in a different type of approach for educating children and preparing them for adulthood. And our project, the Angel Project, is the purpose of that is to establish really homeschooling houses, as opposed to schools as such, you know, where children's honoured, their desire to learn, which is innate, is honoured, and when they want to learn and what they want to learn is followed by the teachers rather than enforcing a set curriculum on them. And that's very exciting because, you know, the education systems, from what I've seen around the world, are, you know, having a lot of difficulties over here in England. There are tremendous amounts of people taking their children out of school now and homeschooling them. And not everybody, you know, actually not every parent wants to have that experience of actually having the children schooled at home, but they want something alternative. So we came up with the concept that we would have houses, individual houses, so they would have a home environment, but it would be using an approach which I was led to in India called the KPM approach to children. That's where we got the basic philosophy of how we want to run these, and it's a unique, wonderful way for children to grow and learn in a very natural surrounding. So we're going to be talking about that, and also I'd like to offer the support, because many parents out there are really struggling at the moment, because you know there's these new type of children coming in who seem very enlightened, very wise, very old for their years, and they're not being understood in many cases. But they've got tremendous energy. They, you know, I'm sure a lot of you have heard the term indigo children. They've been given this label. Really, they're just very wise children, and then some of the existing strict, structured education approaches does not seem to suit them. And so we want to be there for parents who maybe don't know what to do. There's a tremendous resources available at the moment around the world. So we're going to be looking through all kind of stuff like that, and you know, encourage anybody that wants to call in on the numbers there on the website. If it's from the USA, there's a toll-free number, which is 877-876-5227. And if you're in Canada, it's 888-815-9756. Or if you're in another country and you want to call in, it's obviously 1 for the USA, international code 1, and then 530-876-3222. So we'll just explore this and just see how it goes and have some fun. And so I'd like to just introduce you to Patrick Hauser now, and who's a very good friend of mine, and he's from the States himself. So, Patrick, I'd like to welcome you on the show tonight.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I was just thinking the other day, you know, I mean, when was it that we first got together? Probably how long ago?
Probably a good 5 years. And it was in the summertime here in, well, on the border of Kent and Sussex.
Yeah. And can you tell me, Patrick, because, I mean, when I came and met you first, it was clear the course was being brought in by Binny, you know, and yourself. When did you first come across the course?
Probably about 1979. It was before the birth of my second son. And my then-wife had been, we were living in southern Missouri in the United States, and she went to San Diego to take a PhD program in holistic health, and was introduced to breath work and the Course in Miracles. Somehow they seemed to follow each other around. So she kind of brought it back, and then we relocated to the San Diego area and became sort of part of the extended family. And the Course became, you know, part of our lives, most gratefully.
And when you first came across the book, did you immediately take to it, or was it something that grew on you?
I did. Although it was tough going at first, because although it seems benign, but the way in which it operates is so divinely inspired, I guess is the only thing I could call it, which is accurate actually. because it sort of comes in through a back door. It makes statements that don't logically necessarily make sense, but somehow create a wake in anything that's not expressing love. It seems to have an effect that is unpredictable, because it will loosen the mortar if the mortar is not built with love.
Yeah.
So it's really profound in how it works and the way it works, and you don't have to believe in it, you don't have to profess it, you just read the lessons and move on to the next one the next day, and it's quite amazing how it works.
Well, I really go along with that, because I think that's the thing that impressed me, was that there is no need to believe it. There's no need to adhere to the terminology, which is very Christian, in its terminology. And a lot of people who've had kind of different experiences with Christianity sometimes balk at that. But it makes it clear that you don't have to do that.
Yeah, its form of Christianity is different than the conventional. I mean, it definitely has a heart-centered Christ, not a crucified Christ, as a model. And the other thing that was a little challenge about it at first, its language is a bit patriarchal, just because of the, well, I don't know the source of it, with the people who actually put it into form. But in a short time, you can get over that just with your own. But that was a bit of a, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But the message is pure.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think one of the things that really attracted me was the simplicity of working it. Not to say that it's easy, but it's simple. Yeah. And where I am today, it's got to be simple. I don't do complications very well, I struggle with complicated concepts and everything else.
Well, yeah. And the other thing is, I've never found a contradiction in it, or between it and anything else that I've recognized as the truth. I've never found a contradiction. And that's a very good sign.
Yeah.
That's sort of my acid test for the wisdom of things. Are there contradictions inherent in it, or does it contradict something else that I recognize as being the truth, as it were?
Yeah, and I think, that's when I started to get the first learnings of the course is when I attended your and Binny's training, because I mean, I was riddled with guilt, as you remember.
Yes.
that I was up there on the cross all the time,
Binny started working with the course when it first came out, as she was living in New York City, and the books were sold out of an apartment. I guess it was Judith Scutch's apartment, and you would go there and buy them one at a time. There was no such thing as going to a bookstore to get it. This was so new and fresh. And so she became a student right off and has integrated it into her teaching in a way that it's effortless, and it is foundational in all that she does and working with people.
Yeah. Yeah, and that concept, made perfect sense when I remember in one of the courses when every form of attack has its roots in guilt. And that really made such sense to me, that unconscious guilt that makes us want to then attack. We can't handle it ourselves.
Sure.
We've got to push it out there,
Just because guilt and blame are opposite sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
If someone's an expression of blame, it's because there's an essence of guilt behind it that has driven the blame. And instead of going inward with it, which would look like depression or that sort of thing, they're going outward with it, which looks like, blaming someone else.
Yeah.
100% of the time. I mean, that's just how it is.
Yeah. And it's an amazing, I'm not going to pretend that I understand all the text, and I mean, I'm just, as I said, I'm a very early student, but I'm just so inspired by it. And I know it doesn't matter, I don't get hung up on trying to understand the text. I do the exercises to the best of my ability, and then some days I miss, and I can do it the next day. There's nobody going to beat me with a stick or anything like that. That's what I love about it. And but even though reading the text, even though I may not understand a lot of it, I know that it's going in, Mm. And what I find is, I mean, some of the passages are so beautiful, you know, the actual and the deep wisdom. I mean, I was picking a piece out today I saw, and I thought this was wonderful, you know, because I can, you know, I can say, oh, well, that's it, I've dealt with my anger and all the rest of it. And then suddenly I read this piece, and it says, I'll just quote it here, it says, you will become aware that a slight twinge of annoyance is nothing but a veil drawn over intense fury. So, you know, I thought, oh, whenever I'm thinking, oh, that's just a little irritation there, you know. And then the other definitive, because there are, what I've seen is a lot of definitive statements, like you were never angry for the reason you think you are.
Right.
Or you're never afraid because of the cure, you know. The wonderful peace. So, Patrick, tell me, tell everyone that's listening, because I think this is phenomenal. This I remember when you first told me about it, I got a big zing. I talk to people about my zing. That's kind of something that goes off in the center of my gut, you know, that I think this is truth. This is truth, you know. And and then you told me and you shared with me openly about your ideas about putting the products together. So over to you, tell us about how this all started and what happened, and you know, because I know that your involvement in the Source Breath group and your desire to take that into the world of maternity and midwifery and everything else, some wonderful work that you and Benny and your team have done. But this was a new sort of new angle. So tell our listeners what happened.
Well, sort of the short story is that my first son was born in 1976, and we had a home birth. We were living in the Missouri Ozarks, and we had been extremely prepared. We lived well. We grew our own food. We were physically active, lived in a rural setting. We were doing the Mother Earth News kind of lifestyle. And when it came to the time of the birth, we were quite shocked to the reality of a 36-hour labor and an extremely difficult delivery and retained placenta and hemorrhaging and the baby not breathing and a whole cacophony of circumstances that were just amazing to us, because we thought we were very prepared. We read, we talked to other parents, we, you know, were healthy and all of those things. Yet we had never entered into the realm of the emotional world of who we are and how we got to be this way. So we had a very capable midwife, fortunately, so nobody died. Everybody survived, but just. And what, you know, happened next was, you know, kind of a, you know, a couple of years later we woke up and said, what was that? You know, that we were, the impact on us was so deep that we couldn't not notice that something, that we had had a pivotal experience in our lives that wasn't just physical. And so it began an inquiry. We began an inquiry into who we are essentially as humans and how we got to be this way, and how could birth have this kind of an impact, and what creates the birth environment, what is the makeup for it. And began studying pre- and perinatal psychology, which is basically birth psychology, to try and understand ourselves better and our own experience of birth and the experience of the birth of our children, and came to find out, and this was a very new field in the mid to late 70s, and come to find out that, yes, indeed, most women do replicate their own birth experience when they're giving birth. The one they had however many years ago, spiritually, on a soul level, emotionally, however you want to frame it, comes forward and is triggered, activated, and played out on the emotional realm of them giving birth to their own child.
Wow.
We were flabbergasted to learn this and learned it through an experiential process using breath work, where my wife had a session where she just laid down and breathed, and she was guided by a counselor. And through this breathing process, all you're doing is breathing. And somehow it unlocks the door to the subconscious. And she became, there wasn't somebody out here, that Freud wasn't sitting here telling her something meant something else. She was having an experience of her own birth, and the connection between her own birth and the birth of her first son. And it was like an epiphany.
Wow.
So she became aware in that moment that there was a connection, and who we are and how we got to be this way and how we are received as children and as parents is hugely significant. It is, you know, the foundation of our lifetime is created from conception onward. And in our studies of pre- and perinatal psychology came to learn that the baby is conscious in the womb, and they're not only conscious and aware of their environment, they're making decisions about their environment and their experiences. They are having full-blown pre-verbal experiences in the womb, and they're creating conclusions as a result of those experiences. That's a miracle all by itself.
Once that
penny drops.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that led us to, so we then relocated to Southern California where she was in graduate school, and then over the period of the next couple of years, went through a series of sessions and got involved in breathwork quite a lot and the study of pre- and perinatal psychology. And then a friend had sent us an article from the National Enquirer, which is in the States, is a rag.
Oh, yeah.
In England, what they call a rag. You know, and it has everything from three-headed elephants to whatever on the cover.
Yeah.
And a friend had sent us a clipping from this, and this friend knew that what we were involved in pregnancy and birth and such in the research. And it was about Tarkovsky in Russia, Igor Tarkovsky, doing water births with children in water. And that was like, oh, my God. And we were planning another child at that time. And so, you know, within a week or two, we were pregnant. I've seen this article. We instantly became pregnant, right? And, well, is this a coincidence or a clue, you know?
Yeah.
So we proceeded to design the first water birth in the United States and simply had our intuition. We researched, we did what we could, but since it had never been done in the Western world, you know, there was no place to go for research, so we used common sense and talked to people about water and purification and that sort of thing, and put together a little team of people to support us in the process, and at the same time did a lot of emotional preparation. One, to be sure that Catherine, my wife at the time, was clear of the residuals from her birth experience of her first child, because there's this compounding event that can occur where your own birth adds to the birth of your own child, and then that child compounds to the next child. So she did a lot of work
in the form of memories.
In the form of, you know, memories that are activated into emotional outplaying of those memories. Yeah. So we got very clear of all of that, and so I rented a fiberglass jacuzzi and had distilled water and some salt and did what we could to recreate, you know, the womb environment, and the tub was 100 degrees or just about room temperature, and created a living room in the garage with a bed next to the tub and curtains and carpets, and created this lovely environment, soft lights and music and the whole thing. And then she ended up having an hour and a half later and had the birth in water. And I received my son underwater. And we filmed it. And then we did lecture tours, and we came to the UK, and we went to France to see Michel Audin. And it was profound, and it was deep in the team of people involved, and it was a miracle because nobody had ever seen a baby underwater before. It was like, oh, my God. But it was, you know, how long was he underwater? Well, he was underwater 9 months and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So people are amazed that he could be underwater. Well, yeah, he was underwater for 9 months. What's the problem? The cord was connected and pulsing. He was safe. Everyone was fine. And he eventually came up. I brought him up, and my wife held him, and he breathed naturally. We didn't, you know, hurry to cut the cord and all that sort of thing. We let the placenta detach on its own. It was a very amazing process. Anyway, so that sort of continued, or in a way began, our quest into championing conscious birth and taking care of parents and making sure that everyone is received in a way that expands and awakens who they are rather than puts them into a defensive mode and an inability to be free in their life because of past experiences. So,
yeah.
So anyway, that progressed on and on. I moved to England, and my wife and I divorced years after that. And then I'm
so just wonder, what year was this? Give me a clue when this happened. What was the year of the birth?
That was 1980 was the water birth.
And that was the first water birth in the Western world?
Uh-huh. Well, in the United States, and there hadn't been any in England. I'm not sure exactly when Odon in France first had water births. His women started laboring in water just for the comfort and the freedom of it, and then inadvertently gave birth in water. It was kind of a whoops. The baby came out. And I don't know.
Well,
I don't know if that was logged exactly when that was. But by the time we visited there in, I guess it was 82 or early 82 maybe, we went to France. They had already been having water births, but I don't know for how long. So that was kind of the beginning. I'd always, you know, throughout my life, I've been an entrepreneur and had businesses in different industries in different countries and such. And but I always kept a hand. I've been to, I don't know, maybe a dozen births and assisted and worked with adults in releasing residuals of previous experiences, including their birth experience, through the source training. And have always, you know, worked with couples and kept sort of one hand involved in birthing and holistic health and spirituality and such. And then just last summer, a colleague of mine, Elmer Postel, we were in a supervision meeting with a group that we work with the Source Group, and what came out of his mouth was that at some point he thought it would be great to be able to work with fathers-to-be. And, you know, boom, this light went off in my head and in my heart that said, this is the culmination of my life's work. This is what I'm here for. And so at that moment, we initiated fathers2be.org, and we each had something to do for about a month, but after that month, then came back together and designed a curriculum and a whole initiative around fathers2be.org, and then we work here in England and then any place that there's a group of men or a group of educators or a trust or midwives or antenatal teachers that are interested in knowing more about how a man experiences pregnancy, birth, and early fathering. We kind of look at the scope from conception to 9 months old, that 18-month period of time. And indeed, preconception is ideal for couples to begin to bring and invite into their life the spirit and the body of a child before conception. It's a profound undertaking. So it's just a blessing to be able to work with that and have fathers now come into their own, because it's actually a family initiative, but it's focused on fathers because fathers had never had any place to go. I mean, what we've experienced with men being in the room is the first event we did, six men came. We got paid nothing. We asked for a donation to help pay for the room we were renting. But these six men had the most amazing experience, and this was just for an hour and a half. They had the most amazing experience. They didn't want to leave when it was over. And they all shared. Men, English men, shared. It was profound. And what I noticed is when they walked in the room, these six men, they were not six men. They were six fathers. These men were all pregnant, their wives were pregnant, and they walked into this room as fathers-to-be. And there was a distinct, I've been in a lot of men's groups, I've led them and I've attended them, and this was not the same. This was fathers. They were driven here by their passion for loving their partner and loving their family and finding a way into the experience. There is no societal model. There's no precedence, and there's no education, virtually no education, available to prepare fathers for fathering. Yeah. It's a shame, and it's where we are, and we're changing that. So fathers2be.org is an international initiative to work with everyone to support fathers' engagement in the early time. Because the sooner a father is engaged, the statistics, the research that's been done is just phenomenal to show whether, you know, breastfeeding is more successful, postpartum depression is less likely, success in school is higher, lack of truancy is higher, problems, you know, social problems adjusting when they're in their teen years is less, the whole spectrum. When a father is engaged through his heart in the process of fathering, parenting is more successful, full stop. So I'm passionate about it, as you might notice. And I've just written a book, which is in the final editing stages right now, the Fathers-to-Be Handbook, which will be available on the website, fathers2be.org. And it's not about the nuts and bolts. I don't teach fathers how to time contractions or change diapers. I have no interest in that. That kind of stuff takes about 30 seconds to learn, and it's not the most important part of the deal. The most important part of the deal is we ask some tough questions like, how was I fathered? You know, how do I want to be remembered as a father?
Yeah.
You know, what does the way I was fathered have to do with how I'm going to father my children?
Well, that's the point I was going to say. I mean, this is the point.
Yeah.
You know, until we awaken, you know, and we start, you know, we're gonna be so influenced by the way we were fathered and the way we being, you know, it's and even over here, I don't know how it is in the United States, but you know, recently I can remember, you know, my son was going to you know, classes with his partner before they had the child, and they got an air of sort of dismissiveness about his presence there. You know, I mean, there's a real need for re-education within the system,
yeah,
to change that attitude. And yeah. And I know from my own experience of the birth of my own children, you know, I mean, my father wasn't present at any of our birth, you know, in those days, you know, you're talking about early 40s. But when I was there when the same son was being born, and he had a very difficult, my wife at the time had a very difficult delivery. It was her first child, and, you know, there were forceps involved and goodness knows what. And the minute that started to happen, I was dismissed. I was ready to be there right for the whole go, you know what I mean? And but I was dismissed from the room. You know, I was asked to leave. There was an assumption that I would not be able to handle that. And I get annoyed now when I think of it, because today, if that ever happened, it would have been a different answer. But I didn't even question it. I just left because I was told to leave, you know. But
because 97 or whatever percent of births in the United States and England are in hospitals, it's a very, very high number. Men are in a bind because the authority system that's set up, the fix it or replace it system that's set up, is a disaster for men, because if they're not prepared, then typically they end up in a place of confusion and stress and get activated in different ways, anger, fear. And so then they become disabled in certain ways, and then the medical system that's set up to manage birth is and manage a natural process, right? Like manage your breathing, right? Is a disaster then, because then the authority figures take over, and then the man is diminished. He's been told that he's supposed to be the coach, but in my experience, a coach is the most experienced person in the room. Now, there's no way that a father has been prepared to be the most experienced person in the room. That's a severe disservice to me, because you put him in a place where he can't win. He can't win if he does it right. He can't win if he does it wrong, because the doctor is going to come in and overpower the whole situation anyway.
Yeah.
And he's not prepared to that level anyway. So, you know, what's a guy to do, you know? And, you know, we teach techniques for helping men reduce stress and relax, and using NLP and meditation and visualization, so that they can get to a place. The most beneficial thing, you know, a man can do is to be still inside, to be calm. The hormone that activates the onset of labor and also supports the continuation of it is called oxytocin. There's a whole variety of them, but oxytocin is the main one. And oxytocin can be antidoted by adrenaline, meaning it will discontinue the production of oxytocin if adrenaline is present. Now, the thing about adrenaline is it can be communicated across space. You know, if you've ever had somebody come up into your private space and they're all angry, you can feel that. It affects your stillness. It's transmitted, right?
Yeah.
So if a man is all upset and he's at a labor, he's in the birthing room, his upset can be conveyed. Literally, the adrenaline then gets peaked in his wife, his partner, And then the oxytocin is affected, and then labor is affected, and things come to a screeching halt.
Yeah.
So the most valuable thing a man can do is learn how to be in this still place, learn how to be a contributor, because, you know, the roles in birth are almost reversed. Although birth is the most feminine, female process possible, it is actually very male energetically. It is big work. It is physical, aggressive work, working with the baby to come out of the body. That's just the way it is. Now, that's the woman's job, right? Well, the man's job is now to take the more emissive role and actually take on a female characteristic of being passive and being soothing and supportive without a lot of activity. So it's a very unique thing where those hats are switched in the most feminine becoming the most masculine and the most masculine becoming the most feminine. So it's a conundrum to our gender roles to come into this, and there's no preparation for that. That's not discussed. Even in your typical birth preparation classes, that's not discussed.
Well, that's
a very valuable thing to know. Because forewarned is forearmed, you know. If you know in advance what to expect and you can prepare for that, then there's a whole different, you know, possibility.
So do you, in what you're doing, do you encourage fathers to attend your courses from the moment of conception when they know that their partners are pregnant?
Oh, sure. The sooner the better. I mean, we love to have men in the room before they conceive even. I actually had one guy has called so far before conception. But absolutely, and father-to-be is a bit of a misnomer, but unless the baby isn't conceived yet, because as far as I'm concerned, once conception occurs, we have a mother and we have a father. We have a living human being, spiritual, emotional, physical human being present on planet Earth the moment conception occurs. We have a mother and a father.
That's a part that's not really understood, isn't it, by traditional medicine and traditional...
No. And they look at it strictly as a physical process. That's why the whole birth thing has been handled from a perspective of, you know, we have a medical condition here. How can we fix it? How can we solve it? You know, and it's not that the doctors are bad. It's just that they're trained in a different way, that they're medically trained for a non-medical process.
Yeah.
It's something, you know, more than 90% of all births have the potential, and it's way higher than 90%, to be completely normal, natural, and healthy without any intervention. And the other thing that happens with intervention is there's a thing called the cascading effect. What happens once intervention begins and you interrupt the natural process in a woman's body, that intervention then leads to the next stage that's supposed to happen in her body not being able to happen on its own because an artificial input has happened, whether that input is a drug or mechanical or gas and air or these different interventions. Then when that next step happens and intervention occurs again because the body can't handle it, then a higher level of intervention occurs. And the ultimate of the cascade is, of course, a cesarean section.
Yeah.
So it just begins a process, and it's all medical. It's all medical, and this is not a medical process. I mean, thank God for a cesarean, and thank God for emergency procedures when they're necessary. Yes. They are being used.
What I think you're saying is that there's a place for all of that, but in your experience, it is used far in excess of what's needed.
Because the whole system is set up to be outcome-oriented. Do we have a live baby? What is the most advanced thing we can do to ensure having a live baby at the end of the day? Get out the stainless steel and the drugs. We'll make sure that we have a live baby, regardless of the impact spiritually, emotionally, and physically on that child or the mother or the father.
It's coming from, again. It's what we talk about. It's coming from fear-based.
Oh, absolutely, 100%.
Isn't that the challenge that I think we're having now in all these different areas? You know, we see that it's what the course is about as well. Is about letting go of fear. You know.
Oh yeah, there's fear and there's love, and fear is the absence of love. Period.
Yeah.
You know, it's a distraction. It is. At least 5 to 180 degrees, of course, you know, it's pointing the other direction. In my book, I talk about a fathering compass. and keeping yourself on course. That the one of the magic questions we ask is, how do you want to be remembered as a father? Now, that's a brain stopper. Wait a minute, how do I want to be remembered? And so I propose a scenario. It's a few decades from now, and one of your children is asked by a friend of theirs, what was your father like when you were growing up? Well, what if you actually had the opportunity to write the script for that answer? And the truth is, you do have the opportunity to write that script. Because if you write it right now, if right now a man who has conceived a child or intends to conceive a child or has a young child or even children growing up sits and writes down, how do I want to be remembered as a father? And it doesn't matter if it's three words or three pages. How do I want to be remembered as a father? The qualities I want to impart to my child, which, by the way, I'm also going to be imparting to my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren, because all this will be passed down for generations.
Yeah.
This is true inheritance to me. Inheritance is not about the pile of rock or the money in the bank. Inheritance to me is who we are as human beings and what have we passed on to the next generation that enables them to excel and to evolve and to become more human in who they are and what they're here to do, rather than inherit the disabilities. I mean, genes, this stuff where somebody's inheriting diseases and inheriting all these different disabilities, to me, most of those, what you'd call negative or limiting inheritances, are the inheritance of the thought forms and the patterns of the parents.
Absolutely.
Much more than they are than the inheritance of the genes themselves.
Yeah.
And new biology has proved that regardless of what genes we inherit, some genes are triggered and some genes are not triggered. And what triggers or does not trigger the genes is down to the thought forms, the emotions, the lifestyle, how we are in the world is what triggers the genes, not the fact the genes are this way or that way. And that's being proved by science now. So
yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, absolutely. And I know that Bruce Lipton is a friend of yours, I think, the author of the Biology of Belief.
Yes.
And, I think that's what he writes about a lot, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, this is all tied in, you know. It's when I really got it that everything comes from our thoughts, our mind, you know, and that's really what the coursework is about, is it not?
Yes.
It's about changing the mind.
Yeah.
About
yeah.
every situation. And being
knowing that we have a choice is the first step. And then once we have a choice, realizing that our ultimate choice is choosing what we think. We may not be able to choose whether somebody ran over the dog today or whether the light bill was late being paid or, you know, whatever. Some of these physical things that happen are not the ultimate choice. The ultimate choice is what we think about them and how we hold them and how we integrate them into our lives. And that's how we work with fathers is even if, I put it this way, you know, emotionally based, you could have received from your father what looked like a shiny red bike, you know, or a rusty old bike with a flat tire, you know, as far as the gift from the father, you know, but we can learn how to embrace the gift and understand the gift and then be empowered by it rather than disabled by it.
Yeah, I mean, that's and so where are you taking this right now? What stage are you at? And of course, you also talked to me about some kind of gift packs that you which I thought was a lot of fun that you were designing to present.
Yeah, Fathers-to-Be Toolkit. Essential items and information for the expectant dad. And in it will be a variety of things that they're not novelty. They're things that truly support the father. One thing that's in it is my book, the Fathers to Be Handbook. It's going to be a pocket-sized book. So that's the information. And then there's a variety of other things that help support the whole process of, you know, I was looking for something that would be more ritual-like. And so I think what it's going to be is pens, because one of our slogans is Fathers Make a World of Difference. And so men can give these pens to other men instead of a cigar that Fathers Make a World of Difference with our website on it, fatherstobe.org, and can hand these out instead of cigars, because, I mean, who smokes cigars anymore? Who should be smoking cigars?
Well, it's going to be outlawed anyway for the thought to
do. Yeah. That, and we have a stress release ball. It's a little thing that they can squeeze to help work with their adrenaline, and that says on it, Fathers Make a World of Difference. And the globe is pictured on the stress release ball. And affirmation cards and a little compass because a reminder from the book about, you know, where is your father compassing, fathering compass pointing? And have a bottle. Another thing that's in there is a bottle of massage oil, which is father's to be, mother's massage oil. So a little something to take home to mom, you know, to encourage connection. Because it really is a lot about supporting the mom, because she has some really big work to do during this whole period, and it's really important. I mean, the most valuable thing a man can do for his children is to love their mother, full stop.
Absolutely.
That's the bottom line. That's what it's all about. And to be in
service.
And
that doesn't end. I don't think that ends. I mean, marriage continues or it doesn't continue.
Yeah.
I think it's vice versa. The biggest gift any parent can give to their children is to love the other parent, regardless of what that may look like.
Yeah.
Agree with that. Wow. And do you have your book? Because there was one piece, I remember when you first told me, we must have been on the phone for about an hour and a half, I think, but there was one piece you read to me which so inspired me. It was the piece where you were kind of looking back to the old, the caveman. You remember that piece?
Oh, yeah, I could pull that up. I'm sitting in front of
that. That was phenomenal. I really, that really kind of explained so much to me. I thought it was a wonderful piece. You have that available?
Yes, I do.
You remember the piece?
It's called a modern
a
modern hypothesis for fathering. When it comes to a father protecting and providing for his family at birth, here is an interesting hypothesis. The ancient archetype of a father at birth is that he stands guard at the opening to the cave to protect the birthing mother and their child. As we move through time, he comes closer and closer to the actual location of the birth itself, until he is waiting, protecting, just outside the door to the birthing room. And then in the late 20th century, he actually enters the room. His first role was to protect and provide the family from danger, wild animals, or perhaps other tribespeople, survival. As birth became more medical, his role altered. Could it be that the father is entering the room for a more primal reason than we would like to think? Is there still a cave opening to protect? Consider this possibility. Is there a chance the danger is now coming from even closer to the mother and baby as opposed to coming from a distance? Can the danger now be coming from inside the room itself? Has interference from our medical approach to birth, a natural physiological process, reached the point where fathers are now needed to intercede to protect in a new way? Caesarean rates worldwide range from 10 to 80%. Interventions of every unimaginable kind are rampant, and much of what is being done to the mother and child is unnecessary and based in fear. What if a really good reason has evolved to have the father in the birthing room in addition to bonding and support? Suppose that a modern interpretation of protection for a father is to guard against the interference of people, equipment, and artificial drugs into the very ordinary process of birth. Many interventions at birth are the result of overtrained and underexperienced professionals with good intentions who are medically trained to intervene in a non-medical process. Humanity cannot invent a drug that can work better than a mother's body can manufacture, or a knife that is sharper than her instinctual nature. If a mother were properly protected, an environment was provided that was safe and warm and free from unnecessary interventions, distractions, and interruptions, questions, examinations, and conversations, she could get on with the business of being in her instinctual hindbrain and access all of the hormones and inner resources she and her body need to birth her baby in love, safety, and empowerment.
Wow. That is powerful. That is powerful.
That came out one morning at about 4:30 in this writing cycle. I started getting up about 4 or 4:30 in the morning, just getting up, meaning I couldn't stay in bed any longer.
Bouncing
out of bed.
A good sign of where it was coming from. But I mean, that was so powerful when you read that to me, because it is a perfect switch, you know, that switch you talk about from protecting from outside forces.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that I think, I don't think you, certainly not either, it's not about blaming the medical, or blaming anyone.
Not at all.
It's just about highlighting.
We just ended up down a road
that's right.
Happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And it can unhappen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are there callers, John? That do you have access to the callers if there's callers on the program?
I gave the numbers out there. I don't know if
I don't know what if you have control over that process.
No, this is completely new to me. So
yeah, okay.
I gave the numbers out there, but I don't know if there's anybody has called in at all. I don't know if Donald is.
There was a click a minute ago, so I was just curious if that meant anything.
Well, Patrick. It's been an amazing, thank you so much for coming on.
What is your website, John?
Our website?
Yeah.
It's www.theangelproject.org.
Good. Yeah, you hadn't said that yet, so.
and
fathers2be.org, and then also ecstaticbirth.com and sourcebreath.com.
Great. Okay. Well, you know, anybody that's interested that wants to contact Patrick, do you want to give an email address as well, Patrick? Or?
Well, it's all on the website there, fathers2be.org.
Oh, it's all there. Okay.
Yeah, or info@fathers2be.org. Yeah.
That's wonderful.
And to say also thank you, John. You're a man that I've, over this 5 or 6 years that I've known you, has been steadfast in your pursuit of the light and just constantly on game about what is the next highest thought. And this program alone, I think, is a testament to that persistence and consistent thinking and behavior. Because there's thinking and there's behavior, and they don't always match up in the same person consistently, and they do in you. So I acknowledge you for that.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate that. And a lot of it started with your and Benny's training, you know, because that was powerful. And I wish you fantastic success, and give my love to Elmer and Benny as well. I'd like to hear from Elmer sometime, because you know that.
Yeah, he'll come on and talk about early parenting, because he is a young child.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. And that was a wonderful movie that he made with Benny, you know.